Hello, everyone. Welcome to Random Encounter 293 or 293. My name is John O'Logan, and I am stalled on Final Fantasy Rebirth. Not because I want to be. Not because I'm like, you know, taking my time or anything. It's because I had to play another game. And I don't know if you've ever done that before, where you're like, you're playing something, you're really into something, but then something else. You need to do something else. Like in my case, there's another game I need to review for the site. So I'm like, oh no, I need to stop it just when it's getting good. And I finished the game now, and I'm having a little bit of trouble getting back into Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. And I don't know why. There are some games out there that when you're on the train, it's great. And then when you get off briefly for like a little stop and then you get back on again, it takes you a little while to get back into the groove. And, I think this game is one of them. That's not a mark necessarily against it. It just was an interesting thing. I expected to like start playing and be like, oh, this is great. But nope, it was a little hiccup. So interesting. Also interesting are the people that we have on today's episode of Random Encounter. So first up, we have Izzy.
Hello.
And we have Tim.
Howdy.
So gang, we are going to be talking about two recent games. One that shouldn't be controversial. It really shouldn't be controversial. There was nothing controversial about it. And then it became very controversial. And that's all that people have been talking about online in terms of game controversy this week, too. A lot of people have very, very good points. A lot of people are just, I think, yelling because they like to yell. We're going to be talking a little bit about Dragon's Dogma 2. So, Izzy, you reviewed Dragon's Dogma 2 for the site. You really, really enjoy it. It's been getting pretty great reviews across the board, to be honest. So for those of you who don't know, Dragon's Dogma was a 2012 action role-playing game by Capcom. Got released on simul-released on the last generation of consoles and the generation before that. So like PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4. Xbox 360, Xbox One, that kind of thing. And it was a cult classic. A lot of people liked it. A lot of people did not like it. For example, Kyle E. Miller for RPG Fan gave it a 68, which is not a good score. But a lot of other people really, really enjoyed it. And it became a cult classic. People seemed to connect to it in some way. So a few months ago when Capcom announced that they were releasing Dragon's Dogma 2, this was a lot of people enthusiastically greeted this news. And the good news is that enthusiasm was well merited because it's great, huh?
Yeah, it's a...
Yeah. Yeah, see, there's somebody knew we were talking about this, and they're like, microtransactions!
So I'm one of those people that thought the original Dragon's Dogma was a great game. Probably, you know, if I was to rate it, maybe an 80. I always really liked it, but it, you know, is kind of janky, strange experience. And going into Dragon's Dogma 2, that's kind of exactly what I expected, but maybe a little more polished, a little more refined, a little more AAA, maybe. But what I got instead was a weird as hell game that's just as weird as the original. And in many of the same ways, in some of its own ways, and that's a large part of what makes it great.
I should also mention that an expanded version of this game was released called Dark Arisen the following year, which had a bit more story. And let's see here. Rob Steinman gave it a 60. Yikes.
Damn.
We do not like this game here at RPG Fan, but we do like Dragon's Dogma 2.
Apparently.
So I read your review, obviously, and then I went online and just watched a bunch of footage from this. And I just want to start with the fact that this game looks real pretty.
Yeah, it can be pretty gorgeous at times when the vistas, especially, just like you're standing on a cliff, on the edge of a cliff and looking out, and just the amount of detail for like the draw distance and just what you can see out there can be very, very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of landscape simulator, beautiful landscape simulator, Breath of the Wild, Tears of the Kingdom has always rated very highly for me. But this is a much more, realistic view of the horizon. And it's beautiful. Like, and monsters look great, too. Your characters look good. Like, this is a real pretty game.
Yeah, it's definitely impressive. And it's interesting to see, like, it is gorgeous, but then that like the jankiness creeps in sometimes where you're like, oh, this is really, really pretty. And then like a monster comes in and they're like clipping through the hillside, and then like another monster falls off a cliff without even like moving. And
Okay, so there is a level of jank there that will hopefully be patched out of the game over time. So what are we looking at here? It looks like, yes, there is a very specific world with its own mythology and lore, but it does look like a pretty traditional fantasy world. Let's put it that way.
Totally. There is a lot of feeling when playing this game that you're going on like the fantasy adventure of your like childhood dreams.
The overall plot is apparently very similar to the plot of Dragon's Dogma, from what I've heard.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarity there. Like it in a lot of ways feels like they're making the same game again, but how they wanted to make it in the first place. I think they've mentioned as such during interviews. So it's kind of there are a lot of similarities there. There are a lot of things that are different, but it kind of works as both a sequel and a reimagining, I would say.
I read somewhere, I think it was IGN, that they compared it to Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, Sam Raimi's first two Evil Dead movies, where the second one is kind of like a half remake, half sequel. And that seems to be a bit what they're trying to do here, apparently successfully, though.
Yeah, that's not a bad comparison. And I think that they've put out a product here where, as much as I like the first game, I would never expect someone to play that game before playing this one. Like, go ahead, go straight to Dragon's Dogma 2. It'll give you everything you want from either game.
So this isn't so much a direct sequel in terms of mechanics. It's much more of a just play it, like to the point where they didn't even need to put a 2 after it. Technically speaking, they could have just called it Dragon's Dogma and it would have been fine.
They totally could have done that
if they just did a full reboot. It's actually impressive that they put a 2 after it. I wonder why marketing wise they did that.
It is interesting.
Maybe to cash in on the cult classicness of the original. But yeah, it does seem very much like it is a modern AAA open world RPG.
Right. It's an interesting thing to like try and explain is how, yes, it is a modern AAA open world RPG, but it does things so differently in so many ways from the games that we're used to playing that we call open world and then we call RPGs that doesn't really describe it to someone.
What I think, based on your review and what I've seen online, one of the biggest differences it feels is the number of systems that are in this game and the way that the systems interact with each other, especially when you transplant it into an open world. It doesn't sound like quite as massive an open world as some others, but it does seem like there is more stuff shoved into it.
Right. It's super dense. It's very layered. Sometimes you'll go in a cave and you'll think that it's not going to go that far. And then you'll end up coming out like 3 different entrances that are on completely different points of the map and fighting different monsters and like mini bosses and things inside there. And not only that, but like just how reactive the world can feel at times, which is interesting in that it doesn't have like, it doesn't feel like it has like the chemistry systems of, say, Breath of the Wild or something. It's more about the interactions of NPCs, monsters, you, and how that makes crazy stuff happen.
Yeah, you mentioned in the review, a good example of that is the idea of if you are fighting a monster that's outside of your current abilities, you can lead it to town, and the town's guard will help you put it down, but in doing so, some townsfolk might end up dying.
Yep. Anyone can die. Even like plot important characters can die. Luckily, you can revive them. You need to use an item called the Wake Stone. You go to basically the morgue, find their body, revive them. But it's very interesting because there's a limited number of those Wake Stones too. So you're obviously not going to use them on just any random NPC, but maybe you've formed like an attachment to like a side character, and then they get killed by you bringing a drake into town, then you might feel obligated to revive them. It's kind of an interesting dynamic there.
Out of curiosity, without spoilers, I suppose, how do you advance the story if like story critical NPCs die, or do you have to revive them?
So it's, I think there are probably, I haven't had anyone that critical die, so in the first game, if a really critical NPC died, it would give you a message basically like, you can't continue the story now, but you can keep playing in your world if you want, but we suggest you either load an old save or start the game again.
Oh wow, okay.
So they, but since you can revive NPCs in this one, I'm guessing you at least have a chance to revive them before it destroys your save.
That's interesting. So they're not going the Bethesda route that just some people are unkillable. No matter how many times you shoot Preston Garvey, he is not going to die.
The other thing is that so in a lot of respects, you can do things in different ways. Like right at the start of the game, you are tasked with going to the capital city. And you're supposed to like tag along with this guardsman who's like, you're saying you're the Arisen, but the Arisen's at the capital. So how can you be the Arisen? So we're going to lead you back to the capital and you have to prove yourself, basically. But if he gets lost or he dies or you wander off, you can get back. You can get to the capital without him completely. And then you just have to find another way to get it to the capital because they won't let you in without having like citizenship. So you'll have to basically try and sneak your way in or get caught and then maybe from there you'll be able to figure things out. On my new game plus, I just started a couple days ago because I almost never do new game plus. So that kind of shows how interesting this game is to me. But I decided to just not even care about that guy. I just went off on my own and eventually worked my way to the capital. And then I like tried to sneak in through the slums and got caught by a guard. And then I had to be like freed by another character that's an important character of the plot. But yeah, so almost every quest, including the main quests, have different ways you can go about them or things you can skip. So I wouldn't be surprised if even very critical people died if you could still make your way to complete the story.
Yeah, I think when you're designing a RPG like of this complexity, there are... The easy way to do it, the quote unquote easy way to do it, is always to have like a series of backup characters who are just like, in case of emergency, in case of narrative emergency, break glass, and allow these characters who will be unkillable because they might show up on like a monitor or something like that, to guide you through a probably less interesting version of the story if you're just on like a kill everyone run. But I mean, even if you're playing as an evil just don't kill everyone. You're kind of robbing yourself of the experience.
Yeah, it's the funny thing is one of the biggest issues with performance in this game is NPCs themselves, is they can make frames start to drop when you get near them. So I've seen articles online and people joking about how they just kill all the NPCs that they don't care about to like improve the performance of the game.
Gotta free up some memory.
I wouldn't do that, but I understand why someone might.
Yeah, well, you have morals. You have a moral center. We're not going to free up memory.
I like to play as the good person there.
I do too. It's a problem sometimes because sometimes when I'm reviewing a game and it has an evil path, I need to like dip my toe into the evil path to, you know, check and see how things are. And I try it and I'm just like, no, I don't want to kill the children.
Yeah.
And then I feel like there's something wrong with me for not wanting to kill the children.
Most of the time they don't let you kill the children in games, I feel like. So they they stop your
You sure
tendencies.
Can hear.
Oh, okay. I figured as much based on what you're saying, yeah.
That's interesting. I've been playing a classic RPG for the last 2 weeks, a very classic RPG that originally had lots of children in it, and then apparently due to some laws in Europe, the children were patched out. And there are some fan things that you can install to put the children back into the game. Not because you want to kill the children, although child killer is a reputation in that game. So it sounds like they have really flung the doors open to you can be whatever type of character you want to be.
Yeah, totally. And there's not like some score in the background of, oh, you're evil or good or anything like that. It's you just react how you want to react to situations. And sometimes how you react might not have the consequences you expected, but it's not necessarily in the same way of, say, The Witcher, where almost everything you do makes things worse than if you just hadn't shown up in the first place. It's more like there are times where you're like, was there anything I could have done or would that have always ended badly? But there is also times where you actually can do the good thing. You can actually help people. So it the world doesn't feel as bleak as something like The Witcher.
I mean, you got to give them something. You got to give them some crumbs every now and then. Yeah. You can't just constantly have it be a cautionary tale.
I agree.
Yeah. I appreciate, you know what? I actually do appreciate stories that are, that don't have happy endings. I appreciate them. I can't say that I really, really like them. There's something about an ending that is a complete and utter downer that doesn't have a resolution that never really clicked with me. Like, I don't know, there was a movie that we watched in high school. I mean, funny, I was just talking about Fallout. Oh, I ruined what game I was talking about. Oh, well. expect a Fallout review pretty soon, folks. It was The Day After? It was a nuclear holocaust movie. And then the end of it, it might not have been The Day After. It might have been the other one, because this was like a little bit like Deep Impact and Armageddon in the 1980s, where they were just like, we want to make a movie about the end of the world, and it's really sad. And they made two of them unrelated to each other. But I remember one of them ends with like a birthday party and just like a mom and a son and their adopted son they picked up because his dad died, sitting around a table with like a birthday cake, and they're like, it's your birthday. And that's the end of the movie, and you're like, okay.
You know, okay, this sounds a lot like Evangelion in a way, which is similarly is not a very happy ending, or depends on how you look at it, but yeah.
Yeah, I personally like there to be something at the end of it to make, I don't even need to feel helpful. I just need, yeah. Anyway. Okay. So I'm glad that the game gives you some reason to keep fighting, at some point after, you know, everything is bad. Let's talk about some of the gameplay systems that we're looking at here. Cause like they're pretty complex, and we do have they're called vocations in this game, but it's a job system.
Yeah. Job system. You can change your job at any time when you are at either a vocation guild or some inns in places that don't have vocation guilds allow you to change. And you can also change the vocation of your main pawn, which is like your minion party member character. And each vocation plays wildly differently from each other. It's almost like playing a different game in some respects. And you level each of those up separately from each other, but you get a pool of points called DP that you spend to upgrade skills and add skills and things like that. And that's a shared pool, but each one has its own level that the higher the level, the more skills and things you can unlock. Mm-hmm. And then there's also augments, which each vocation can unlock that you can have, I think, six of those equipped at once, and they can be equipped no matter what your current vocation is. So you can do things like get every single stamina recovery or boosting or whatever augment from across all the different vocations, and then have stamina that never runs out and is massive. Or you can get huge defense even though you're a mage, or things like that.
Neat. You say that your favorite one is basically a dragoon.
Yes. The Mystic Spear Hand. It literally has a dragoon jump.
That sounds like a no-name dragoon. Like,
yeah.
Like a generic, like something you'd find at a grocery store. It's just like, oh, generic dragoon. Okay.
So the main things it has going for it to differentiate it, its spears are double-ended for fun, I guess. And it feels a little bit like playing as or like looking at like Viper coming up in Final Fantasy XIV, that job that they're adding with the staff that can be split into two weapons, except you can't split it into two weapons, but you know, the whole using a staff, but you can use both ends that have a blade on it. So the character does movements that aren't just like stabbing, but twirling and hitting with the back and things like that. And then it has a jump just like Dragoon. It has like a dash forward you can easily kill yourself with by launching yourself off cliffs, but is also very useful for getting to places that might be hard to get to otherwise. Like, oh, I can climb up on this cliff, but I can't get to that other cliff across the way. But now that I'm a Mystic Spearhand, I'm just going to launch myself across the gap and reach the other side. And it has, like, you can launch magic energy bolts with it, and it has an invincibility shield that is ridiculous. It definitely feels like the favorite child of the developers in a lot of ways. Just has so much going for it, but it is very fun.
How does the combat work in this game, really? So it's action-based, so it's not, like, turn-based or anything like that.
Yeah, it's completely action. You only have direct control over yourself. You can give like basic commands to your pawns. Like there's like one on each direction of the D-pad, like help me, go ahead, come back to me. I don't even remember what the fourth one is, but and they do actually listen to those, so those can be very useful, but generally they're just AI driven doing things on their own, and you're doing things on your own. The way in which it differs from a lot of modern action RPGs, like say Souls games or mm-hmm. all the Souls likes out there, is that it has
or like 16
yes, a true or like a Devil May Cry or something. It's a lot more there's a different kind of pacing to fights, in that a lot of fighting in this game is thinking about what you're going to do before you do it, rather than just doing things, because that will usually get you killed. And you can't
like life.
And you can't just do like the Dark Souls thing of like, I'm really good at parrying, or I'm really good at dodging, so I don't really need to, like, once you get good at those games, you don't have to be as careful about things, because you can just use your invincibility frames to escape pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. Instead, every vocation has like a kind of defensive ability, but very few of them are directly defensive. So like mages and sorcerers, they can levitate. So you can levitate up to a cliff or levitate out of the fray or something, but it's not like you can still get hit when you're levitating. There's no invincibility frames related to it. You can't block, you can't parry. You're trying to find somewhere in the battlefield where you can make the best use of your spells, because they take a long time to cast, but do massive damage or cool things that you can cast those spells from without getting murdered. Or like the Mystic Spearhand, like I said, has an invincibility shield, which I do feel like is too good, but you still have, it still takes, like, you have to not be being attacked to cast it. You have to, and it takes a little bit of time. So like someone might knock you out of using it, and it uses up some stamina, so kind of there's a bit of balance there. I do still think it's too strong, but and then like a fighter has a shield and they can block with their shield, and the thief can roll like a Dark Souls character, but they're the only one that can. Archers like are pretty mobile, but like, and they attack from far, but they don't have any direct defensive action really. They can like kick their opponents back away from them, but if it's a big monster, you're not going to knock it over with a kick. So there ends up being, when you're just, your defensive options in combat are often positional almost. It's you're thinking tactics. You're thinking, how do I not get killed by this? Where do I attack it from? How do I attack it? Rather than I'm just going to attack it, and I know I can protect myself if it does something weird.
The interesting thing, we were talking a few minutes ago about NPCs, and I imagine that this is also a problem in combat occasionally. How's the performance here? Because there have been quite a few comments online about performance specifically with the PC version.
Right. So I played on PS5, and I will say, based on what I've heard from both friends and online, that I think the PC version probably just has more performance issues.
I mean, that's almost always the case.
Yeah. But it might be to a pretty big degree here. So while the PS5, it has uncapped frame rate. I think they're doing a patch where you have the option to do capped at 30. But I would say most of the time it's pretty stable. NPCs do the weird thing sometimes. Sometimes there's a bit of ghosting when you spin this camera really fast or something, but overall performance isn't that bad. But there are times, like, and I've been through like huge boss battles with like no major performance hiccups or anything, but there's just some times where suddenly the game just starts getting real sluggish. And sometimes that like is for reasons that you're like, oh, okay, this makes sense. Like, you decide to have a party of all sorcerers who all cast giant magic spells, and you're fighting a boss. Then, of course, when there's like four blizzards on the screen and the boss is launching like lightning from the sky, it's not that surprising that it starts to get sluggish. But other times you're like doing just some regular battle against a mob of like orcs or something, and suddenly you're in a slideshow and you don't really know why. But I would say like the vast majority of my time with the game, I wasn't noticing any big issues with performance. But I will say I'm not a person that's generally particularly bothered by performance issues. Like, unless it's something that's actually like making the gameplay hard, I rarely am bothered by it. And in this case, there was not really times where it affected the gameplay for me.
Yeah, I'm a little bit the same way, where it'll be a little bit of annoyance, but eventually I'll adapt. My only problem is when it's so poorly optimized, it crashes. Or something happens that actually like stops the experience dead.
Right.
And I have a great deal of, okay, sympathy is the wrong word, understanding to an extent. Developers, when they are developing for the PlayStation 5 or the Xbox, obviously they every single Xbox or PlayStation 5, at least until the Pro is released, is the same damn thing. So it's a lot easier to optimize than when you're dealing with a PC version that people are going to be installing on AMD cards, they're going to be installing on NVIDIA cards, ranging from anywhere from probably a 1080 to a 490. There's so much with different amounts of RAM, and there's a lot of balls in the air. My sympathy vanishes when they release it anyway, even though they know that it's going to be horribly optimized. But I mean, clearly it's a problem, and that's going to be a problem for years, as long as people are still buying the stupid things, even though they have poor performance, to the point where I would be almost understanding for more delays on PC versions if it means that you got a better overall experience.
I agree. I would, at this point in time, based on what I've seen from both myself and other people, I would probably recommend playing on console for now. But it does, like, Capcom's already released statements about patches they plan and things, so hopefully hopefully those are quick, and hopefully people still want to play it by the time they get those.
That's a great thing about ChatGPT. You can turn out those apologetic statements to placate your Reddit users in like 2 seconds. It's fantastic. Speaking of that, let's dive into something that I don't really care to talk about too much, just because it's so goddamn annoying. Microtransactions. So microtransactions are a way of life in certain genres of video game. For example, mobile. If you play mobile games that are not like Apple Arcade, you are almost certainly going to be running into microtransactions. And I'm not even talking about some of the scammier ones. I just mean, like, in general, it seems to be an established practice in mobile games that you can sell little boosts or things like that, and people will, in fact, buy them. The traditional argument is that, yeah, but mobile games don't cost you $70+. So this is a full price single player game, and there are some rather scummy looking microtransactions in it, including like microtransactions to enable fast travel or to change your character's appearance or things like that. Now, later it came out that there are items in this game that allows you to do many of these things, but it's still a little weird, but not unprecedented, because Capcom's been doing it for many of their games lately. What do you think, Izzy?
Right. So at the risk of sounding like a corporate shill here, which I do not want to, because I 100% am against having these microtransactions in a full price single player game, I do get the vibe from the kind of DLC that Capcom games end up having that it's kind of like a mandate for the suits at the top, and the developers try and make it as unneeded as possible. So to that degree, I think that is the case here as well. Some of the things on paper look worse than they are, like the fast travel you mentioned. So how fast travel works in Dragon's Dogma 2, there is two main types of fast travel. There's ox carts, which are basically just in cities. You can hire an ox cart to take you to a nearby city. The ox cart might get attacked while you're on the road. If it does, you'll have to defend it. If you fail to defend it, it might get destroyed, and then you'll have to walk. But most of the time, it's a pretty quick way to get between two cities without any repercussions. And it's just in-game gold, really cheap. The other thing are there's these things called fairy stones and port crystals. So a port crystal, there's one near each of the main settlements in the game that's just always there. You just have to find it and interact with it, and then you can use fairy stones to teleport to those. You also can find 10 port crystals in the game that you can place anywhere you want, and then you can move those at any time. You have to actually go to them physically and pick them up and move them somewhere else, but you can move those, and they basically are let you create your own fast travel points. With the microtransactions, super weird. You can buy one single port crystal, but that you can then place in the world and add yourself an extra fast travel point. But it's not actually extra because you can only have a max of 10 in the world and there are 10 in the game. So you, if you buy that microtransaction, you could end up with 11 and only be able to put 10. So it's...
Okay.
And yeah, you only can buy one. I do, like, it's a weird, and it feels bad because someone's getting tricked into buying that, but it's also like, if once you know about it, there's no reason to ever buy it. And then the other thing is the character appearance changes, which I can understand sounding more annoying, and it is frustrating to a degree because you can buy those in game, but currently. And they're not that expensive or anything. They're easy to get. You can find them at any town. But you can only buy two of them per save file currently. Mm-hmm. And then you can buy, I think, just one extra one through microtransactions. Now, one of the things they've promised in their upcoming patch is to increase that from 2 to 99.
Ah.
Yeah. So, and I know, like... For a lot of people, they like to change their character a lot. But for me, that just is like the character I started the game with is the character I want to finish the game with. So mm-hmm. It's not going to affect me, but I know it's going to bother some people. So hopefully once they have that patch and it's at 99, no one will be complaining about it because that's a ridiculous amount of times during one playthrough. And like upon New Game Plus, you also get to change your appearance if you want.
Yeah. My thought about this is that... I think that it is scummy, and I think it is just a reality of the game's business as it currently exists. Yeah. And unfortunately, I don't think that there's going to be any movement and these controversies and people getting angry about it on the internet. It doesn't work, like simply because people still buy the stupid games.
And so, we have Sid's horse armor, so.
Exactly. So as horrible as it is, this is just going to continue until eventually they reach a point where, no, we rebel, and then they back off, I don't know, 50%, and then keep going again in the future.
You kind of like, if they keep them around this point, is it scummy? Yes. Is it that big of a deal? No. It's where if they go past this kind of thing, which some games definitely do, and it's more a matter of is this going past this going to become a common thing? Because that's when it becomes more of a concern to me. Like when it's just like kind of pointless things that maybe like are scummy because they'll convince some people to spend money on them, but are not actually something that affects the gameplay of the game. I don't want to say I'm fine with that because I'm not really, but I don't care enough for it to be an issue to me, but there's the worry that it would get worse. And so far, I think a lot of studios are afraid to push it too far. So
This is also like, it's on the topic of Capcom, but as well, I'm also into fighting games. So Street Fighter VI has a lot of these as well. They've kind of continued with the same, you know, high price practice for like cosmetic stuff. So with Capcom in particular, I feel like they're probably not going to back off. I'd be very surprised if they did.
Also, I kind of feel like gamers right now are like all of us are just being like oblivious parents where we're like, I would expect this kind of thing from Ubisoft, Capcom, but from you. And it's like, no, they're equally bad.
Yeah. Like your only hope is you have developers who do the kind of thing where they try and not make it actually affect the game, even if they're told they have to implement them.
And to be fair, that's what your overall score is based off of. Your score is based off of the experience that you get when you play the game, if you don't buy a single microtransaction. And that's a pretty good score.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. So I'm really, really glad you enjoyed this game because this is the kind of thing. It's nice when cult classics get follow-ups that don't just live up to the original, but maybe even push it slightly more into the mainstream. And it seems like this game certainly is because it's very, very popular right now.
Yeah, I agree. I'm quite pleased with the reception it's gotten overall, despite any controversies or stuff. But most people who've actually played it and haven't had to deal with PC issues seem to be greatly enjoying it. And to me, it feels like a balance of, yes, the game is that much better than the original, but also I think we're in a place where people were more ready for a game that's this esoteric and weird because of things like Souls and Baldur's Gate 3 and games that play by their own rules.
It was just a little bit ahead of its time.
In some ways, yes.
Yes. Well, before we move on, I just wish to say that the 1983 post-apocalyptic film that I watched was called Testament. Testament, not The Day After. Apparently there was Testament, there was The Day After, and there were Threads, all of which dealt with post-nuclear holocausts, which, wow, that's a depressing topic, but not unprecedented, because that's the kind of thing with like Dante's Peak and Volcano, and with like a parallel film development where two things, Ants and A Bug's Life, what's the big one? The asteroid movies, Deep Impact and Armageddon. People just kind of do the same films with slightly different points of view, which is kind of a cool thing when it happens. Anyway, Testament, real depressing ending. Specifically, I wish to say, here's how it ends. The family is finally seen sitting by candlelight to celebrate Brad's birthday, using a graham cracker in place of a cake. When asked what they should wish for, Carol answers that we remember it all, the good and the awful. She blows out the candle. Although not depicted, it's probably inevitable that Carol, Brad, and Hiroshi subsequently succumb to radiation poisoning after the end of the film narrative. So real ray of sunshine to show. Especially because this would have been like the mid-90s. This is not a, here kids, just in case you need to climb under the table in case a bomb is dropped. Ugh. Anyway. Okay, well, let's move on to we have survived the winter, and we are going to Mars. Actually, no, let's go with that. The world's over, so we're going to go to Mars now. And we're going to be talking about a game called Mars After Midnight. So, Tim, you were on a few weeks ago to chat about Under the Castle, which was a Playdate game. And Playdate is a very interesting little console. If you want to know more about it, listen to the episode we recorded a few weeks ago. It is a little Game Boy-looking handheld thing with a crank on the side of it, and it's yellow, and it's really cute. And they have a very interesting distribution method for video games, which is they release them in seasons. And when this thing was announced, the game that really drew, I would say, most of the attention was Mars After Midnight, because it was going to be Lucas Pope's next game. Lucas Pope, famously, of Papers, Please and The Return of the Obra Dinn, and it was only going to be released on the Playdate. Which is like, oh my God, that's quite a coup and very interesting. So this was a really hotly anticipated game. It got released, and I'd say it's probably the most highest profile game released to date, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I could just see it being the highest profile game released, and that's not just because of, you know, not anything against the console, but just because, like, you know, this is very much a console for indie devs, and like, you know, he kind of took a very long time to make a game that is what it is, but ultimately like is extremely polished and could easily have come out on another platform with this level of polish, but you're not going to see this very often. So it's kind of funny to be back to back here talking about Playdate games, but I think this one in particular, as you're saying, really had a lot of buzz, especially because, you know, these days, now that we're kind of past the seasonal model, they now have a catalog, and the catalog allows people to buy, you know, whatever curated games that Panic, the publisher of Playdate, decides to put on there. Mm-hmm. So this game, $6, it's like, it doesn't cost much, but is this like massively, like, as you're saying, like shock, it's almost shocking that somebody who's just had like two massively successful games that are increasingly getting bigger in scope would then go on to take like 3 years to make like a tiny little thing for like Playdate. But yeah.
Well, let's talk about, for those who don't know Lewis Pope's games, Papers, Please, iconic indie game at this point, where you are playing as a border guard or inspector, I guess, to an unnamed fictional fascist country of some kind, and you have to decide who to let into the country or to reject at your window, and your decisions change the world and your family as well. Like, if you let someone in, if you sympathize with the rebels and you let someone in, yes, the country might get freer, but, you know, your family might go hungry because you're not getting paid that day. So it might be one of the hardest games I've ever played in my life, not in terms of difficulty, but in terms of just like, it's hard. It's asking you to make some hard choices.
And it's stressful.
And it's super stressful. God, it's stressful. And then there's Return of the Obra Dinn, which is just mind-blowingly awesome in every conceivable way, from its presentation to its story to its voice acting to its music. It's a friggin' masterpiece. This game seems to pull from Papers, Please much more than Obra Dinn, in the sense that it's kind of an inspection-based game.
Yeah, exactly. So I would almost say it's a direct successor in so much as like the style of game it is. You're not a border inspector agent in this. It's kind of more lighthearted. You're kind of running a community center that at midnight opens up to like a support group for Martians, and you have to like pick six based on the different ones that come to your door, just kind of how they would come through, you know, in border figure out which ones to let in, which ones to not. So it's the same concept, and I think maybe this is getting it's kind of, maybe this is a little uncool for me to say, but like it's you know, I think we looked at Papers, Please, and we're like, okay, well, this is a game where you're playing a role. It really is like a role playing game when you look at it. And I think we looked at Mars After Midnight and we're like, okay, that's probably going to be very similar. And while it is a very similar game, as we'll get into, I'm sure, momentarily, like the simplicity of it really causes the whole idea of playing a role to kind of go away because it is just so basic to a fault.
Yeah, it starts falling back. It's a system based adventure game, I would argue, more than anything.
I would say so.
Now, very different from what you'd expect to see from a lot of indie games. This game really does fall on Lucas Pope's, I would say, unique aesthetic, which is different in every single game, but there's something similar about it in terms of its simplicity. And I think visually speaking, Mars After Midnight is a perfect match for his particular visual style, which is certainly with Oberdin was one bit, no colors. In this case, it is also no colors. It's white, black, grayscale. So that's a real good fit for what he does.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think on top of that, I think there's also the fact that like you get a similar aura from his games because he, you know, is one of the developers who does the art, who does the sound, who does the, you know, game design, the programming.
He's an auteur.
Yeah, exactly. So like everything you're getting from him, I mean, I'm sure there may be some collaborators here and there, but really on this, the credits are just him. So he did everything, and with his past work, I'm not sure what Oberdin, but for Papers, Please, I'm pretty sure it was all him too. So, mm-hmm. So you're definitely, there's definitely like a through line there as well. Though I will say, you know, both Oberdin and Papers, Please are very serious, sometimes harrowing games. This one's very lighthearted, and not that that's a bad thing at all. In fact, I think it's actually very interesting that impressive that he's able to do both things. You know, in so much as like the tone of the game, he does it very well. So yeah.
He seems like the kind of developer that would make a game for the console, for the specific console, the platform, rather than try to make it fit. In this particular case, this feels like a game that is very specifically designed for the playdate. I don't think that we're going to be seeing a port of this to PC or to the Switch or anything like that. It feels like it was made for this system, and it was made for kind of this short, you know, it's a handheld. It's not even a Switch style or a Steam Deck style handheld. It's a handheld in the style of a classic Game Boy. And for that, I might be wrong because I'm obviously not in his head, but I feel like this would be he wants that lighter tone because it reflects the console that it's on.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I also think that, like I was mentioning earlier, there's like a very indie type of thing, type of scene around this handheld, and that, you know, scene very much brews these more lighthearted games. So it's also just kind of fits into the tone of what's being made for this platform. There's very little made for this platform that's like super serious, you know? It's a lot of them are either fun mini games or stories that are kind of like cheeky and whatnot. So again, like he definitely both in story and in gameplay created something with this in mind. It's interesting because Papers, Please, you know, kind of the fun thing about that game is when you're playing on a PC, you basically have like a desk laid out in front of you, and you have to like sort through all these documents to try to check them against, you know, immigration papers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a whole mess, but it's the feeling of actually having to, you know, manually go through all those things in that kind of space aesthetically that works. they did port it to iOS, and the game's still pretty great there, but it loses that. So I do think, like, yeah, I think as you're saying, he does make things for certain platforms, and, you know, even if they're ported to other form factors, something probably does get lost in the process, but could still work. But I think Mars After Midnight is a game that's probably not going to make it out of the playdate, only because it's just so specifically made for this console and for the type of people who own this console.
Let's talk about the gameplay loop. So yeah, the gameplay loop of Mars After Midnight is, you're obviously going to get a little bit more deeply into this, but it is a more, I guess, simplified version of the gameplay loop of Papers, Please. How does that work?
Yeah, so I'll just go through like a cycle of it real quick. Sure. So each day you run this community center and you pick your support group. So the one it starts you off with is like depressed Cyclops or something. So they have to have like one eye and they have to have a frown of some description, and they'll knock on your door. You'll open this little like flap. It's like I don't know really what to call it, but like a
peephole.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good way to put it. And you can kind of look. You only ever see a part
Jesus
of
Christ,
these.
You asked me that question literally like 4 weeks ago, and I racked my brain for like an hour trying to remember the word for it. And now I'm like, it's a peephole, and just right off the top of my head, brains are stupid.
By that same measure, I completely forgot what you had said. But even though I wrote it in the review, I think. There are like all these really cool, unique Martian designs, which is a big highlight of the game. And you're able to only see a portion of it at any time. You can kind of look up, down, left, right through this peephole to kind of see the different aspects of these creatures. And I guess for this example I'm giving, you're looking at specific like traits of the creature to then let them in or not. So if they have both those traits, then you say, okay, you let them in. If not, you close the shutter with the crank and the next person comes up. If you let them in, there's then this kind of little mini game that goes on where you have to like, how do I describe this? You have to set a table in a certain way with like a snack, and there's plates and other. Yeah. And then
yeah, you need donuts.
Yeah. And then when the Martian comes in, they'll, you know, mess everything up, and you have to like put it all back together again and clean the table, which actually is another crank motion, which is, it's, you know, all this stuff is, it's very polished. It's very, you know, tactile and fun. Mm-hmm. And while you're doing that, you'll hear, you know, knocking at the door to go talk to another Martian. Now in my game time, I never came across anything that like penalized me for like taking too long. Which is maybe a criticism I have of the game, but regardless, you end up back there, and once you get six of these Martians in, the support group will happen, and you'll, you know, repeat. And you'll probably go through like 30 Martians on a given night to figure out which ones, you know, should be let in. So, and I should also add, every knight has a different gimmick. So like one gimmick might be, okay, you have like a calculator and they're going to give you like a math. You give them like a math equation and they'll give you an answer. And if it matches the equation you have, then you let them in. Another one might be like, oh, do they have wrinkles? So you have like a microscope and you can like look up at their face and like, yeah. So just little things like that. I think one of my favorites, even though it's kind of on the simple side, is like you have to see if they're able to dodge a punch. So you just have like two boxing gloves and you just like try to hit them. And if they dodge, they dodge. If they don't, they don't. Which, yeah, again, at least in concept, I enjoy it. So, yeah.
I think from what you're telling me, the real difference here is, and similarity is, with Mars After Midnight, every single night there's a new gimmick.
Yeah, exactly.
And similarly to Papers, Please, where like constantly new rules would be put onto your plate about who you can let in, who you can't let in. The difference being, it seems, and the real stress of and difficulty of Papers, Please, that is that some of those rules are eventually contradicted or changed to other rules, or those rules are altered. So you're constantly trying to keep this constantly shifting number of criteria in your head. And change with the whims of this fascist government. Whereas it appears like Mars After Midnight simply just gives you a different thing every single night, and then they let that gameplay element go.
Yeah, and so I guess this is where I should get into why I'm very critical of this, because my review of this is a 60 out of 100, which is, you know, as we kind of talked about earlier in the podcast, not the brightest score. And
it's,
you know,
as good as Dragon's Dogma, folks.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, this is coming from somebody who, like, Papers, Please is like a monumental game for me. That changed the way I thought about games when that came out. So, and it's because of the way that the systems would add on top of each other. They'd be changed, and you'd constantly have to be rethinking how you're going about all these different tasks. And it just becomes, as you said, it's very difficult because it becomes impossible to manage. And at the same time, there's a stress of like, oh, my family is going to die if I do not do well. And then your family probably does die. Here, it's like they will introduce a mechanic and then the next one, and then that will be it. And usually those mechanics are very simple. Just to go back to the example I gave before with the boxing gloves, like you press a button and it's very clear right away whether they should or shouldn't be let in. So like there's no challenge there. And this is like a later game. That one in particular is like a later game mechanic as well. The hardest, and like the hardest they got are like the math equations, and they're still pretty simple math equations, and there's no time limit that I could really tell either. So like if you really needed to, you could like go and do the math equations yourself. So even that's not difficult. It's unfortunate because you can see, I think there's a lot of variety, but there's very little depth. And I think you can see where he could have, you know, thought a little bit bigger here, because I think he looked at this and thought, okay, playdate is a small thing for bite-sized sessions, so like let me make like a kind of simple fun thing. But I think he took it a little too simple. Instead, he could have like had us do multiple different check for multiple different things, which is kind of what Papers, Please does. He could have, like, there are some where you have to like, you have like tarot card readings or something like that, and they'll give you like they'll talk to you something, and it's like warbled voice, and then you have like a kind of, if you pause, you can like go and look at like this like Blabodex is called of all what these different, you know, sounds actually mean. And you know, there's so like those like systems are in place to like have multiple things going on at once, but it never really happens. And the one other thing I kind of want to note as well is I noted that the Martian designs are one of the, you know, best parts of the game. But at the same time, I feel like they're done a disservice, because very rarely are you actually engaging with the designs of these creatures and how they look, which is kind of funny, because in Papers, Please, the aesthetics of the people actually was a big part of the game, even though they were far less interesting looking than these Martians. They're just
grotesque
kinda,
in places.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So to put it to put it PG. So
Lucasbook didn't quite land the, I don't want to boil every game down to Mario, but like the classic Mario thing of introduce a mechanic, refine the mechanic, give a variation on the mechanic, give a final test on the mechanic, kind of gameplay loop. Whereas here it just seems like he introduces these really interesting ideas and then just drops them without really developing them or bringing them in later. And that seems like a bit of a waste in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Or definitely, as you say, missed opportunities.
Yeah. Actually, one other missed opportunity I want to talk about that is also underdeveloped, I think, is, you know, the story is told without any exposition, but there's a lot of cute little cutscenes that will happen before, between the, you know, different shifts and whatnot, and that can maybe happen during but the main like goal is something that's like impossible to get to and is eventually just given to you, and it just feels like there's not much satisfaction in actually getting to the, you know, end story-wise. Even though it's not a complex story, it would have been a cute fun one if it didn't feel like the agency was just completely taken out of it. And I just feel like, you know, again, like this is something Lucas Pope has always done very well, is being able to tell his stories.
Unconventional ways too.
Oh, exactly. I mean, and this is a, you know, maybe a little less unconventional, but still unconventional enough. I'll say this, and I didn't put this in the review for obvious reasons, but it's just kind of my speculation, is that, you know, this game for the Playdate community is a big deal. And I think, you know, I've seen mixed reactions. You know, a lot of people do really like it. And I've seen a lot of people who would agree with my opinion on it as well. But at the end of the day, I have to imagine that Lucas Pope is probably working on another project as well. And this is, we said it took him a long time to make this. I'm sure he is working on another big game, and this was kind of a side thing for him. So I don't really want to play this as like, oh, he's lost his touch. I think just for him, this was not a priority. That's completely, I have nothing to back that up, and that he hasn't, announced anything else. But would assume that after Oberdin, he would be working on the next big thing. And this is clearly not, was never meant to be that.
Well, Tim, there's also the other possibility. And again, obviously no inside knowledge here or anything, but as someone who used to do creative work for a living, there are unfortunately times where you come up with an idea that you really, really like, and it's a really good idea, and you start writing it, and you are about midway through, and then you're going, oh, this isn't quite working the way I wanted it to, but you're already in so deep, so you keep writing and you finish it, and by then you already have a deal in place, or you have people who are looking forward to reading it, or you might, there are basically, you're on a fast moving platform and you can't get off, and it's the more you work on it, the more momentum it gets. I don't know if that's the case here, but it does seem like this game lacks the same focus as his previous two titles. I don't think that means that he's lost his touch. It just could mean that this was a game that he had an idea for it. He started working on it. He started developing it. And it just never really came into focus in the same way as his other titles. It happens sometimes.
Yeah. And if you look at his devlogs, a lot of the stuff he talked about was like, oh, here's how I'm making these modulated voices. And the presentation of this game, even how it controls and everything, is all very polished. And there are, there are a lot of actually interesting ideas that he has on display here. So I think he probably had a lot of fun making it. And, I don't want to speculate too much, because I really don't know. That's just, I think at the end of the day, I think it's $6. It's not a bad time. It's just that as a critic, it doesn't really come together. But for somebody who wants something that's going to last 3, maybe 4 hours at most, and just will probably put a smile on their face here and there, I think it is a good pickup. But from the perspective of a critic, it's not quite up to par for him.
We're critics, but we're also fans. It's right there in the name. And when something like this happens, when something like this comes out and it doesn't live up to expectations in a way that feels not just critically but objectively, this is interesting, this isn't quite what the previous things, it does create a sense of curiosity in us. And we start asking ourselves questions wait, why didn't this come together in a way that the other games did? I don't think that's weird at all. And I don't think it's uncharitable either. It seems like it's a perfectly cute little game for a console that has a lot of cute little games.
I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah. But, at the same time, I do think there are games that I felt are more substantive on this platform. Mm-hmm. And it's a little disappointing to me, I guess, also that the kind of marquee game, at least for now, of the platform, at least for me, doesn't live up to what some other games have been able to achieve on it. But anyway, at the end of the day, I'm still really looking forward to whatever he has next. And
hopefully we won't need to wait too long for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, before we wrap this thing up, I wanted to bring up a discussion question with you both. This is based on a couple of days ago, actually, for not just a couple of days ago, a few weeks now, there have been significant rumors that Microsoft is going to be releasing a portable console in the very near future. It almost got released, it was really hinted it was coming a couple of days ago. And I found this very interesting, because up until the Switch, it always seemed like the dynamic was that the flagship console was going to be a stationary console in the living room, and then there might be a handheld console that supports it. But then Nintendo Switch came out, and it really showed the potentials of a hybrid console, which is one you can take around with you and you can play on, but then you can plug it into a TV and play it as a stationary console. And since then, of course, the Steam Deck came out, and the just countless Steam Deck clones at this point. And Sony recently released the PlayStation Portal Remote Player that allows you to stream your games to this handheld console like thing. It looks like a Switch and someone's glued a PlayStation controller on either side of it. So it does seem like the way of the future is going to be handhelds, maybe, you know, hybrid handhelds. So my question for both of you is, I'm just curious, do you personally prefer a handheld gaming experience, or do you prefer a more traditional standalone living room console, and why? And where do you think the industry is heading in the future?
So it's an interesting question. I traditionally, previously, through much of my childhood, portable gaming was kind of my main platform. And that was mostly due to the fact that portable consoles were cheaper and I could have my own, while the consoles were kind of the family's console or my older brother's console or that kind of thing. So yes, I played on console, but I got to have like my Game Boy and that was mine. Mm-hmm. And I could play that at night when people thought I was supposed to be sleeping and things like that. So I've always loved portable consoles. I've always been a big fan of them and liked what they do. And I mean, I have a Steam Deck. I really like my Steam Deck. But I would say there is still something holding both the Switch and the Steam Deck and potentially future hybrid more consoles back to me. And it's kind of just the... So for the Switch, for example, I love its promise. But I have had more issues with that console than any console since the Xbox 360. Where I had like five rings, red ring of deaths. So that's its own big issue. But like, I've had
the five red rings of death sound like a curse of some kind.
Very much so. Could definitely Indiana be in like Jones a fatal and five frame, ring rings of death. Fatal frame game. Or, yeah. So I've like, it's, I've had to send it in for repairs more than once. I've had, like my fan no longer works in it, so it like overheats within like 30 minutes of play now and all this stuff. There's the whole Joy-Con issues that everyone has had to experience. It just feels like for the Switch, the quality wasn't always quite there, and I love what they were trying to do, and I feel like there is a chance that for me, at least, Switch 2 might hit it out of the park. We'll see what they end up doing. Wait,
did you just call it the Switch? Oh, you called the Switch 2. I honestly, for a second, thought you called it the Switch U. And I'd be like, that would be the funniest thing they could ever do.
Oh, gosh.
But like, and then you have something like the Steam Deck and all those, like the Legion Go and all these PC handhelds that, while super cool, and I love my Steam Deck and I use it all the time, you still have like all of the issues that PC has, but then you have, it's not quite as simple to like troubleshoot things and fix things. And so you, with something like Steam Deck, you don't know if a game is going to run perfectly or not at all, or that kind of thing, until you're really playing it. Even games that say they're verified sometimes don't actually work. So I think the state we're at with portable gaming right now is very exciting, but also kind of worrying at the same time. And I'm interested to see what Microsoft might bring to it. If they can make a really nice polished console that has Game Pass, I think that could actually sell. Like, I've seen a lot of people say, what can an Xbox offer that Steam Deck doesn't already? And they can offer a console that, you know, every single game works and runs well and potentially is also just a nice piece of hardware. We'll see. And I have kind of the same hopes for the Switch 2, and we'll see what comes there. And like any future iterations of the Steam Deck, like Valve is trying harder, like they're constantly updating things. So while there are there are always the issues to be had and things, they are clearly all in on the Steam Deck. So I don't know. I feel like portable gaming potentially has a pretty bright future. And that excites me, because for a while I thought we might not have portable gaming at all anymore, other than like phones. So that's cool. It's more a matter of does that promise actually get realized or not?
Yeah. You know, I guess I come from a similar place as Izzy, actually, that I come from like a handheld background as a kid as well. I really grew up in like the Nintendo handheld. So even going back to like the original Game Boy up until, you know, 3DS, I was on board for all of that. I actually got my start as a writer in 2009, writing about mobile games. So that, again, more like handheld stuff. I think in the early 2010s, I'd say, actually. I got kind of into PC stuff, but quickly, like, when I got a couch, was like, oh, it's great to, like, sit down and, like, play things on my TV. So I think as time goes on, I prefer to play, like, the bigger games on my TV, even if there is an option to, like, play it handheld and Switch, like Tears of the Kingdom, let's say. Like, I'd prefer to play that on my TV just because I feel like I'm getting a more cinematic experience that way, I guess. And I feel like I've, you know, invested in like that setup to like enjoy games, you know, in that capacity. But at the same time, you know, so I'm I guess I've more gravitated towards, you know, couch playing, but I think handhelds are actually the future in some way, and that people want to be able to play their games wherever. I think, you know, especially we're talking about RPGs, you know, here as well, like, you know, the turn-based RPGs are like great on handhelds, obviously. And, you know, Switch has done very well for those types of games, I think. So I don't think Nintendo's going to change course.
Nintendo's never going to change course.
Hopefully not, because it would be a bad business choice for them. I mean, they have like the model, and frankly, like, most people don't even notice performance issues because they're not as invested in games. They're just playing a couple things a year, and they probably own like a Switch and they're happy with that. So I think, in so much as where the money is coming in, I think, you know, a lot of that is in this like these hybrid consoles. Does Steam Deck have a dock? I'm actually not sure.
You can hook it up to a TV. Yeah. I don't know if there's an official dock, but you can hook it up to a TV. But then if you're plugging it into a TV, especially if it's like 1440p or 4K, more than likely, you're also going to be pushing a lot more pixels.
Yeah. Yeah. That is an issue with the Switch too, though. 1080p to 4K isn't so bad. You know, it's more the 720p like UI that's a little rough. I guess with Microsoft, it really seems like their model, at least if they had their way about it, is to put, you know, Game Pass on as many things as possible. So to have, I would almost find it kind of strange for them to make their own handheld, because I would think they would want to put Game Pass on other people's handheld. They would want to have, you know, a Game Pass app on Android, iOS. You know, I know there's a lot of laws, you know, that may prevent that right now, but like,
they're breaking them. You can hear them in the background. Yeah. They're coming for them.
Microsoft's coming to get me. It's funny because the last podcast we did, none of this happened.
It's cool.
Anyway, so yeah. So I don't know where I left off, but basically, yeah. I think Game Pass, you know, will Microsoft's. I think what Microsoft wants to do is like propagate Game Pass to other things. So I just think having their own handhelds is not really going to work, especially because the Xbox really hasn't sold very well. And I think that brand is never really going to come back, if we're just being honest. And that's nothing against Xbox at all. I have an Xbox as well, and I enjoy it when I play it. But it's just, I just don't think that brand will ever be competing with Nintendo and Sony again. So, you know, I think, again, I'm curious, but I just inherently find it to be a strange move. I would think more they'd be like, let's put Game Pass on Steam Deck, you know, and like promote that and try to get more people to buy. Maybe not more people to buy Steam Deck, but you know what I mean. Like, try to get out in that way. Yeah.
Do y'all remember the rumors when we were talking next gen, the series, and or there was a rumor that in Japan they would sell them as the Sega Series X or whatever. Do you remember that? And I was just thinking, like, what if that for their handheld, instead of Xbox, they got another name to attach to there? Time for the Wonder Swan to come back.
I mean, wouldn't it be amazing? It would make me extremely happy if, completely out of nowhere, Sega announced a portable console called the Dreamcast 2, and just everyone's just lost their collective for me, I mean, when I was a kid, I was I moved between my Nintendo console and my handheld Nintendo console, the Game Boy, and I played a lot of PC games. And then I eventually, when I went to college, I didn't have a lot of time for gaming, so I moved into handheld gaming. So like my DS, I went through two DSs because the hinge broke on one. I was using it so often. And then I got a 3DS and I loved all of them. And then I got away from console games for a while and was playing everything on my PC. And then I got somewhat back into console games and I started moving away from handhelds. I don't play handhelds very much. I think that the future might just be hybrid consoles. And my reasoning is because this might be completely wrong. My reasoning is because large companies, even though they keep pumping money into it, they are recognizing that budgets on video games are getting ridiculous. If you win, if you end up with a hit, it pays off. If you don't, you're going to lose an awful lot of money. I feel like ballooning development costs might lead some of these companies to view a much more limited console with more limited capabilities that can be both played on TV and portably as their primary console. I think it would make them look at that kind of a console with a little bit more of an interested eye. Because it's a possibility that A, they can latch on to some of that sweet Switch Steam Deck money, but also it would allow them to somewhat restrain the ballooning development costs because they'd be working with somewhat more limited hardware. And they would be able to do it in a way that would not draw the ire of a lot of gamers out there saying, oh, you're abandoning the hardcore console gamers because you're not turning out the most powerful console ever. Like the PlayStation 5 Pro, everything got leaked a few days ago and the resounding response from the gaming community was a shrug. They're like, who cares? It's what we have is powerful enough as is. I think that we are collectively beyond the concept of, console go vroom. And I think that we would like more as a collective group of consumers, I think we would like more options, more portability, frankly, to be able to take the damn thing wherever we want. And I think that's why hybrid consoles are probably going to be the future, at least for the time being.
Yeah. I mean, also on top of that, the PlayStation Portal seems to have been selling very well. And while I haven't used one, I don't personally see, I've used both Microsoft and Sony's streaming service, however you would call it, mm-hmm. before, and it always, it's very laggy, even within my own network. So I don't see that as a quality gaming experience, but clearly people want that. So I just think, the desire is clearly there in this product that people thought was just going to be a throwaway has clearly done pretty well. So
yeah. And I think something, Tim, you said a second ago that is of interest to me, the idea of Xbox wanting to put, or Microsoft wanting to put the Xbox Game Pass on a variety of different consoles. Right now, the company that is drawing a tremendous amount of ire, certainly in the EU and certainly in the United States, is Apple with the App Store. And I have a lot of thoughts about that, which don't belong on this podcast, but something that Apple has in common with Nintendo, with Sony, with Microsoft is all of them have their own dedicated stores where they control everything. And yeah, they're not considered monopolies because you can still buy to this day, you can still buy physical copies of the game. So they're not the only, that's not a monopoly. They're not the only game in town, but these companies don't want to give that up. They don't want to create open platforms. I think it's the reason why Microsoft will never, ever create an Xbox that is essentially just an open PC, because they do not want Steam on the Xbox. I think they'd love to have their store on other consoles, but they would never want to open it up to other people, their own to other people. It's a big question where the console wars will go in the future, and I don't know where the answer is.
Hopefully
away. I don't know. I don't want them to go console wars in terms of the crap online and Reddit threads and things like that. Yeah, I'd love that to go away. But having three competitors in the console wars, two of which are directly competing with each other. If the console wars were a schoolyard, you'd have Sony and Xbox playing over by the basketball net, and they're competing and playing. Then Nintendo's the weird one in the corner sketching, doing their own thing. That's been the way for quite a few generations now. And I think that is not what I would call the healthiest marketplace, but is considerably healthier than there being one or two platforms, period. So more platforms means more competition, means more innovation means better games. So the console wars, in theory, I like. The console wars rhetoric, I hate.
You're you know, trying to say like there's, you don't want a monopoly with one or two systems. You like the competition.
No, and there never will be. Yeah. Like, I mean, there's always going to, like, Nintendo isn't going anywhere. Nintendo is, even if they have to back up, they're doing fine, especially even if their next console is another Wii U level flop, I think they're going to be just fine.
Yeah. I mean, they just made all the money from Switch. So
yeah, Microsoft could be in trouble if the next console is a flop, and Sony's doing fine.
I think it will be, though. Like, I don't think the Xbox brand can ever be as strong as it was, and I'm skeptical it can be close to where Sony is at this point. I just kind of think people are set in where they are because that's where I think, you know,
they're locked in ecosystems.
Yeah, Phil Spencer said something along the lines of like the previous generation, the Xbox One, PS4 generation was like the worst generation to lose because that's where people really got locked in and built their digital libraries. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Like, so I think that it's going to be hard to convince people to switch over when all their games are already in one ecosystem and may carry over in some way, at least some of them, to the next console, you know?
It's a huge advantage, but I also don't think it's insurmountable. You just need two things. One, three things, I guess. You need to create incredible games that people really, really want to play. You need to create a piece of hardware that is peerless and does an amazing job. And then you need one of your competitors to screw up somehow.
Yeah.
And honestly, definitely, those three things are not unforeseeable. I mean, it was impossible to imagine Sega getting out of the console game or the Saturn failing as hard as it did. But like, stupid decisions are made every day.
I mean, if Nintendo somehow flops their next console and then Microsoft comes in with a better portable, there's a chance there.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
I wouldn't say that I would have high expectations for a Microsoft portable otherwise, though I'm curious about it. But like, if it's the best closed ecosystem in town, it might have a better chance.
Yeah, and if you could carry over your games from the Xbox One onto this console, as well as new games being developed for it, that would be quite a interesting thing for a lot of gamers. Anyway, we gotta leave this here because we have to leave because it's getting a little late and we've run a little long talking about this. But I would like to thank both of you very, very much for coming on and talking about your respective games and certainly delivering the reviews for those who are curious. The links to those reviews are going to be in the show notes, or you could just visit rpgfan.com and check them out. If you're looking for a way to support us here at RPG Fan, we've opened up a store. You can find it at www.rpgfan.com/shop. The thing I'd like to draw your attention to among our coffee mugs and t-shirts and things like that is our collaboration with Hyperplay RPG, which is the RPG Fan review card collection. And it is a showcase of nearly 300 of our review cards, as you can see on Instagram. And they are great little pocket reviews. If you ever want to just take a look through and say, ooh, that game looks interesting. Because I don't know, sometimes there's going online to look for new games or old games, it's very, very difficult because there's just so many of them. So being able to have a book where you can just flip through and go, I've never heard of that. I think that looks really cool. I want to play that. Genuinely a invaluable resource. If you'd like another way to support us here at Random Encounter, you can do so by checking some of our old episodes. Last week, we were chatting about Unicorn Overlord, and we were talking about a fan game prequel to Undertale entitled Undertale Yellow. Really, really interesting games. Unicorn Overlord, a spiritual successor to Ogre Battle, and, well, Undertale is Undertale. And it sounds like these fans really did a good job emulating the style of Undertale with Undertale Yellow. So I recommend checking out that episode. But we are not the only podcast here at RPG Fan. We also have Retro Encounter. Over the last 2 weeks, Retro Encounter has been focusing on Final Fantasy IV, which was my very first RPG I ever beat beginning to end. I love Final Fantasy IV. I still think it holds up in many, many ways. So absolutely check that out. We also have Rhythm Encounter, which is RPG Fan's music podcast. Last week was RPG Fan Safe Spaces, which was focusing on music that provides kind of a sense of downtime. Like, I know this isn't an RPG, but like the music you hear in the typewriter room in Resident Evil would be a good example of a safe space. If you'd like to get in contact with us here, you can fire us off a message at podcast@rpgfan.com. If you have any suggestion for future episode ideas or discussion questions, as you hear, we can get carried away with discussion questions. So absolutely, drop me a line and suggest something. If you'd like to send me an email, you can do so at jlogan@rpgfan.com. You can also find me on Mastodon at johnologan@mastodon.social. I am not the only person on here with an online presence. Izzy, where can we find you online?
I continue to avoid social media, but if you are, I tend to be told or notice when people comment on my things on RPG Fan socials. So that's probably the easiest way to catch my attention. You could also just message Jono instead. I'm sure he'd give it to me. And I think I should also note that I think Final Fantasy IV is the worst Final Fantasy game.
Oof. Okay.
I can't send myself feedback complaining about you, Izzy. Yeah, Tim, where can we find you online?
You know, I'm similar boat. Don't use too much social media. I'm at Tim or Trey, but I'll just kind of follow on the Final Fantasy IV bandwagon here. A couple months ago, I actually had a review for the Switch version of the Pixel Remaster on RPG Fan as well, so go check that out. That was actually my first time playing the game. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Gold star.
Yeah.
You out of the two of you, you are getting the birthday graham cracker. The three of us are going to be sitting at the table and it's going to be going to black and you are going to be eating your birthday graham cracker. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends to help us get the word out there. If you enjoy talking about bad apocalyptic 1980s movies, apparently this is your place to be. I'd really like to thank both of you for joining me today. Really, really appreciate your time. Really appreciate both of you.
It was a ton of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No problem. And everyone out there listening, whatever you're playing, have fun.